To some, the nascent nuclear age promised quite the utopian future indeed, one in which everything from your wristwatch up to entire cities could be powered by nothing but the humble atom, which held seemingly limitless potential for cheap, clean, and abundant energy. And while some of this vision was realized, I mean, cities, for example, kinda nailed that one by and large, but the wondrous utopian future that was promised to us has also had a lot gone unrealized. Take watches, for example, disappointingly not nuclear powered, barring a single prototype Seiko rolled out in the 1970s. Now, this isn't a particularly groundbreaking revelation in and of itself. As is common knowledge now, the nuclear engineers of the late black and white days dreamt big only to see their hopes dashed. But what is less well known is the sheer breadth of nuclear machines that we've had a crack at making over the years. Some successfully, some unsuccessfully. And today, to shed some atomic-powered light onto the matter, we will be having a look at five such machines. So let's jump in. Now, you're likely already probably aware that nuclear-powered aircraft carriers are a thing. They're quite a big deal, after all. And some of the more fastidious ship spotters among you might even know that there are also nuclear-powered cruisers out there, an example of which is the Russian Admiral Nakhimov. But what you might not know is that nuclear propulsion is not just the preserve of warships, and that actually there also exist civilian ships that employ it as well, the best examples of which are found in the fleet of atomic icebreakers maintained exclusively by Russia. Notably, the country's history with icebreakers goes way, way further back than the nuclear age, all the way to the 11th century to be precise, when northern settlers began using heavily reinforced wooden sailing ships to facilitate navigating the Arctic seas and Siberian rivers. And since the ice didn't exactly go anywhere, neither did the demand for such ships, and so they evolved along with the changing technology of the day, eventually becoming steam-powered in the 19th century, diesel-powered by the early 20th century, and eventually, for a select number of them anyway, nuclear-powered a few decades later, with the first among them being the Lenin, which entered service in 1959 and was eventually decommissioned in 1989. Powered by three individual miniature nuclear reactors, she made a very good impression on Soviet leadership, as she immediately went on to play a vital role in their Arctic operations, being able to cut through ice with unparalleled efficiency thanks to the monstrous amount of power having three nuclear reactors on board can deliver. The ship had essentially unlimited range as well, thanks to her reactors only needing to be refueled every few years. And look, this would be a big deal on any ship, but for one based in Siberia, where there's not exactly filling stations everywhere, it was pretty world-leading. Not to say that the ship was perfect, though, because there was an incident in 1965 where one of her reactors got a bit melty during refueling because someone drained her coolants before removing the spent fuel, which normally would have been done the other way around. But hey, I mean, what are you gonna do? It was the Soviet period. People apparently couldn't follow instructions. How many of us have been here? You know, you're running late, you're barely out of the door, you're really hungry, but there's no time for breakfast. Well, that's where today's sponsor, Huel, comes in. This video is sponsored by Huel, and if you haven't heard of them, well, you're about to hear about them. You're hearing about them right now, and the next thing you want to go do after that is get some Huel, because it is the world's number one complete nutrition brand with over 400 million meals sold worldwide. Which is an insane number of meals. They've got their Black Edition ready to drink, which has 35 grams of protein, 27 vitamins and minerals, and it's all packed into one bottle. There's no prep, there's no cooking, you just grab it and go. It is super easy. And the taste? It's kind of like a milkshake, but with, you know, nutrition. You got your choice of chocolate or vanilla, plus it's low sugar. You could say goodbye to hangry moments and unsatisfying snacks and just fuel up for the day with Huel. Plus, super affordable, you can get a complete meal for less than $5. Honestly, a bit of a no-brainer if you ask me. So if you're tired of skipping meals or settling for junk, give Huel a try with my exclusive offer. You can get 15% off your first order. Just head to Huel.com and use the promo code SIDEPROJECTS at checkout. That's 15% off to fuel your day and you won't regret it. Thank you to them for sponsoring, and now back to today's video. Undeterred by such niggly little foibles, however, Soviet leadership then found found itself wanting to keep the momentum going, and so it commissioned a whole class of brand spanking new nuclear-powered icebreakers to follow in Lenin's wake, specifically the Arktika class. Six of these would be built in total from 1971 onwards, with four of them being built during the Soviet period and the final two being completed by independent Russia. And those two are, incidentally, also the only two of that class that remain in service to this day. But that's not all, because they also commissioned the Taimyr in 1989 and the Vegach in the following year, a pair of sister ships that, although shorter than the Arktika class, are built with a way shallower draft to allow them to operate much closer to land and within river estuaries. Both of them are also still in service to this day. And then there's the snappily named Project 22220 series, a planned class of seven, of which three have been built and entered service, with the first one, Arktika, named as a homage to her Soviet-era forerunner, having entered service in 2020. And if you've been counting, that brings the current fleet up to a grand total of seven. Do consider that a provisional list, however, because for some reason just trying to find a list of the ones they've got in service at present is bizarrely difficult. We tried, but we might have missed some. Do note, though, that we haven't forgotten the Sevmorpet, although a cracking bit of kit, she is a merchant ship rather than a true icebreaker, so we decided not to count her. As for what Russia does with them, they are primarily tasked with maintaining the Northern Sea Route, ensuring year-round passage for commercial, military, and supply vessels through the Arctic. They also play a crucial role in supporting the extraction of Arctic resources such as oil, gas, and minerals, and assist with scientific research and polar expeditions. Some are even used for tourism, offering voyages to the North Pole on big 13-day-long jollies that comfortably drop you off at the pole in a helicopter. And if you're wondering how much one of those trips will set you back, because we certainly were, that would be a cool $31,000 for the most Spartan cabin and $48,000 for the fanciest one. So I guess we'll be giving that a miss. Sticking with nuclear-powered transport for now, but just on the smaller scale of things, let's have a look at cars. Yep. Cars. Despite the very obvious reason why it wasn't a very smart idea, i.e. the possibility of a minor fender bender becoming a level 1 anomaly on the international nuclear event scale, they were something that was pursued very heavily during the nascent atomic age. And there is one such attempt that you might already be familiar with, as it has become rather famous in recent years, and that would of course be the Ford Nucleon. First unveiled to the world in 1958, it was a concept car that envisioned a small, rear-mounted nuclear reactor that would propel the car using fissile material to boil water, which would generate steam, and that steam would then be directed to drive a turbine driving the car forwards, more or less the same way that a nuclear power station works, just with the turbine being hooked up to the axle rather than an electricity-producing generator and, you know, also being essentially in the boot of a car. Further still, with the Nucleon, Ford spoke not just of a new sort of car, but of a whole new way of motoring, with them envisioning that petrol stations the world over would eventually be pulled down and replaced with reactor swap centers, where a motorist could drive in when their 5,000 miles of prospective range run out and have a new fully juiced up reactor bunged in with no greater difficulty than that found in swapping out the batteries in your telly remote. What is less well known, however, is that Ford were far from the only car company to flirt with the idea, with another notable example being the Studebaker Packard Astral. But while the Ford Nucleon was very much grounded in reality, with its production only really being held back by a will of both politicians and the public to make it a reality, the Astral, which was also unveiled in 1958 as a concept, dreamed bigger. Oh, so much bigger, with it not only being nuclear-powered, but also only having one wheel, which was to be gyroscopically balanced. But even the Astral was nothing compared to the Simca Fulga. Unveiled as a concept in 1958, yet again, it was even more out there. Intended to show what cars would look like in the year 2000, it was never seriously considered for production, but it did come with a wealth of proposed features such as voice control, a radar-guided autonomous driving mode, and balancing on only two wheels when it went over 93 miles per hour. And to be fair to Simca, while they may have been way off the mark with the nuclear propulsion and retractable reels, the voice control and autonomous capabilities, well, that ended off not being far off the mark at all. Just not really by the year 2000, right?
349.
249.
I said three.
And yet, despite the incredible motoring future that those concepts promised back in 1958, nuclear-powered cars, never worked out, all for the very sensible reason we mentioned at the beginning of this chapter. You don't want to have a crash and spread radiation all over your driveway. And on a certain level, that's a bit of a shame. Not the radiation spreading, the lack of nuclear cars, because say what you like about the whole potential for inadvertent nuclear disaster thing, it doesn't change the fact that a nuclear-powered car would be way cooler than anything that uses combustible dinosaurs as fuel. And if you thought nuclear-powered cars were a stupid idea, you ain't seen nothing yet, because they also had to go cramming reactors into aircraft, and on both sides of the Iron Curtain too. But there was at least some logic to it. They weren't just doing it because they could. You see, they were tried out in the days before ICBMs were both highly refined and available in large quantities, and so they couldn't really be depended on to end the world should the many sabers rattling about at the time accidentally strike one another. As a result of those shortcomings, big strategic bombers were the go-to choice for the superpower's apocalypse-causing needs, as they could fly long distances reliably and carry large payloads of nuclear weapons that could be aimed accurately enough. The job wasn't entirely a good one, however, because such aircraft had a major Achilles heel, and that was, of course, their range. Now, this might sound crazy to say, considering that a B-36, the US's go-to strategic bomber in the late 1940s and early 1950s, could just about squeeze 12,000 miles of range out of a single tank of juice, which is certainly quite a lot, but it's not a lot when you consider how they were actually deployed, as in times of particular crisis, the Strategic Air Command put them in the sky and held them at the edge of US airspace so that if the Rubicon was to be crossed, they simply had to turn toward the Soviet Union and they'd be there in no time at all, as well as being well out of the way of any preemptive strike. A smart, strategic idea, absolutely, but deploying them that way used a lot of fuel. And because the B-36 had no aerial refueling capabilities, they would have to be constantly rotated in and out of the sky if a constant presence was to be maintained. So, I mean, wouldn't it be better if you just had an aircraft that didn't need to be refueled at all? And that, right there, is the logic for a nuclear-powered aircraft. Eager to see if such a thing could be created, the US created the Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft Project, which later became the Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Project in 1946 and 1951, respectively. They both did exactly what they said on the tin, which in turn led to the creation of the NB-36H, which flew between 1955 and 1957. As you may have already deduced from its name, it was a nuclearized B-36. It carried a 1 megawatt air-cooled nuclear reactor that itself weighed in at a hefty 35,000 pounds, in addition to a further 24,000 pounds worth of protective rubber and lead lining for the crew compartment. This was a lot, to be sure, but for what was only a proof-of-concept prototype, it wasn't actually that absurd, as a B-76 could happily carry 72,000 pounds of bombs on a normal day. But do note, contrary to what many would have you believe, this reactor did not power the plane. Instead, it was only there to provide data on how the presence of a nuclear reactor might affect its systems and crew. In parallel, the Soviet Union pursued its own nuclear-powered aircraft, the Tupolev Tu-95 LAL. Like the NB-36H, it did not power the aircraft, and instead was only there as a feasibility study. Ultimately, neither design would progress any further. The NB-36H was grounded in 1957, and the Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Project itself was canned in 1961, and similarly, the Tu-95 LAL only made 40 flights between 1961 and 1969 before its project was cancelled. The reason why was the same in both nations. ICBM technology had improved to the point that it was no longer worth the environmental risks. On the technical level, however, it is certainly a shame that we never got to see how the idea of nuclear-powered planes progressed, as some interesting ideas were being thrown about. The Soviets, for example, for their production nuclear-powered bomber, the Tu-119, envisioned turboprop engines powered by both nuclear fuel and paraffin, and the Americans threw about the idea of a direct cycle system in which air would be heated by the reactor and then expelled through a jet engine. But while interesting to muse over, it's safe to say that Mother Nature is no doubt thanking us that these ideas never left the drawing board. And if you thought that sitting inside of a nuclear-powered aircraft was a bit of a balmy prospect, how's this one for you, which sounds even more absurd? Nuclear-powered pacemakers. Yep. pacemakers, as in that thing that you get surgically crammed inside yourself to keep your heart beating as God intended. And it gets a bit madder still, because they aren't like nuclear-powered aircraft, i.e. an idea that sounded briefly like a champion one, before common sense prevailed and they were canned, and instead they were a crazy-sounding idea that actually turned out to be both really good and get adopted reasonably widely. The idea behind using nuclear energy for pacemakers is now a familiar one: longevity. They were developed in the late 1960s and early 1970s, a time when chemical battery technology was still rather crude, to say the least, and by using plutonium-238 as a power source, which has a long half-life of 88 years, they could last even longer than the patient they were shoved in, reducing the need for repeat surgeries down the line. One was first implanted in 1970 in Paris, but unfortunately, a reliable figure for how many were fitted in total really isn't easy to come by. We've seen some sources say that 600 were fitted globally, and others that 1,600 were fitted in the US alone. We unfortunately just don't know for sure, at least from what we've been able to find out. But with figures like these being thrown about, we can be sure of one thing, and that was that while they were implanted with reasonable regularity, even in their heyday they were far from the norm and always remained niche. They also work in a pretty clever way, as they're not a miniaturized nuclear reactor, at least not a conventional one. Instead, rather than working by using controlled nuclear fission reactions to split radioactive atoms, releasing heat that is used to produce steam, which drives a turbine to generate electricity, they work by exploiting the fact that plutonium-238 produces heat through its natural radioactive decay and converts that heat into electricity using a thermopile, which powers the pacemaker. Now, with that said, let's address the obvious question here, that being, how the hell are these things safe? Well, it turns out that thanks to the radioactive material being encased in robust layers of titanium and epoxy, with built-in redundancies and fail-safes just to be sure, it appears as though they are actually very safe indeed, with the typical patient implanted with one receiving no greater a dose of radiation than they receive from a yearly dental x-ray. They are also so well built that they are even able to stay sealed and safe when subjected to gunshots and cremation. Despite how well built they are, however, public concerns about physically implanting nuclear technology emerged when they came onto the scene, which is often cited as the main reason why they were never more widely rolled out. And perhaps such concerns were not entirely unfounded, because while they were built to an unbelievable standard, they do have to be disposed of under very strict conditions, with ones implanted in the US having to be removed from a patient following their death and sent to the Los Alamos National Laboratory so that their plutonium can be recovered and prevented from accidentally polluting the environment or being collected for nefarious purposes. Come the 1980s, the rise of lithium-powered battery pacemakers spelled the end of the nuclear-powered variety, as they could still run reliably for years at a time, and did it while generating none of the same concerns around disposal and safety. As for how many are still out there today, we've got no idea, as we couldn't find a single source that commented on the matter. We did find evidence that 50 to 100 individuals still had them as of 2003, so it's likely some of them are still out there. But given that 2003 was 21 years ago, that number's probably going to be pretty tiny by now. And for our final entry, let's look at an unusual application of nuclear technology that sounds much more sensible at face value: lighthouses. They came about in the mid-20th century in the Soviet Union, which through the fickle hand of geographic fate had found itself as the custodian of a huge chunk of one of the most remote and inhospitable regions on Earth, the Arctic coastline. This presented a number of challenges, because as we learned back in Chapter 1, they did regularly send shipping their way. They had to, really, and so lighthouses were clearly needed, and yet traditional power sources such as diesel proved surprisingly unreliable in those harsh conditions where temperatures could easily drop to extremes of minus 30 degrees Celsius. And further, just to that, actually getting diesel to such remote areas was a logistical nightmare in and of itself, given how far from civilization they were. What they needed was a reliable power source that lasted for years with minimal fueling and maintenance, and so, naturally, nuclear power was quickly decided upon as the solution. They didn't use what you'd call a normal reactor, however, and instead they used radioisotope thermoelectric generators, or RTGs. These work in a very similar way to what we saw in pacemakers, actually, with them producing electricity by converting heat from the decay of radioactive materials into electricity, with the radioactive material in question being strontium-90. When all was said and done, they worked an absolute treat, with over 1,000 of them being installed along the Soviet Union's Arctic coast. And that's a big as far as we are aware, because, you know, the Soviet Union and all that, none of them ever suffered any kind of accident, at least initially. They did after the collapse of the Union in 1991, however, as following this, many of them fell into neglect, were shut off and abandoned, or were just simply forgotten about altogether, and as a result, accidents began piling up. Nothing Chernobyl-esque, mind you, but still bad things to be sure. For example, scavengers dismantled two RTGs on the Kola Peninsula back in 2001, and the radioactive cores, which were left behind, began emitting dangerous radiation levels up to 1,000 röntgens per hour, i.e. enough to send you up to St. Peter via acute radiation poisoning in a matter of days after just an hour's exposure. The local authorities, quite understandably, deemed the situation a radioactive accident and moved to remove the strontium-90 and decontaminate the area. With incidents such as that in mind, international efforts have been made to strip all the abandoned lighthouses of their radioactive materials, with a notable example being the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which saw the US and others provide assistance to Russia to secure or dismantle the abandoned RTGs. The results of these efforts are unclear, however. Some sources are insistent that they were all dealt with before relations with Russia and the rest broke down a couple of years back, and others are insistent that some are still out there, lost and undocumented, full of radioactive material, just waiting to be stumbled upon.